Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. A powerful state lawmaker resigns unexpectedly. Politicians and campaigns are blaming the media. That's not a surprise. And the two major party candidates for governor set a date for a debate. I'm Dave DeWitt, managing editor for news here at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief.
Great to be here.
Let's start with the surprise news over the weekend, Jeff, that Representative Mike Hager, Senate Majority Leader from Rutherford County and a Republican, will resign his seat. The news was first leaked from an internal GOP notice that there would be a vote on his replacement before anyone knew that he was resigning. Then Hager did announce his resignation. Jeff, who's Mike Hager and why do we care about this?
This is noteworthy. Mike Hager is a third-term representative from Rutherford County. Rutherford, for you non-geography fanatics, is west of Charlotte, out near Shelby, North Carolina. And Hager, in his three terms in the North Carolina House, has become a well-known, prominent voice and figure and leader of, the Republican efforts. He was a majority whip, and then he was the majority leader this past two-year session in the House.
In just three terms.
That's a quick ascension.
Yeah.
He's been involved in environmental issues, and, his focus has been on he's worked to change, tax provisions. He's been a conservative voice, a leading conservative voice, if you will. And he's also somebody who made a bid to be Speaker of the North Carolina House back in 2015, has had, some butting of heads more behind closed doors than out in public with Speaker Tim Moore. They're not besties, if you will. But Hager, this is very surprising. I mean, Hager is of the however many 70 or so Republicans in the House. He's one of the most influential, most powerful, along with people like Tim Moore and David Lewis. But this is very surprising. He cites the need to spend more time with family, his children. His father is evidently ill, and that's obviously lousy to hear. But this is surprising, and I think it's only natural for one to wonder what else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is just a family situation, and best of luck if that's the case. But does he have his eye on another office? Is it just time for him to focus on his career and his family?
Right.
I don't know, but it's very surprising and different than, and I'll zip it here in a second, but different than the departures of Tom Apodaca and Bob Rucho and Skip Stam, some other prominent Republicans in the General Assembly who left after the short session this year. We knew those were coming.
Right.
This came out of nowhere.
Right. The timing is so strange,
yeah.
Right? If you're going to do this, you do this 2 months ago. So it makes you think that something has changed.
Right.
It's interesting now that it is in social media. Some people say, well, there were rumors of this back, at the end of the session, but nobody said that there were rumors
then. Right.
So, they weren't strong rumors, and there are rumors about everybody. It's a pretty strong Republican area, so it seems like another Republican can slide in there,
yes,
and probably win the seat.
That's the expectation.
Mike Hager tried to repeal the renewable energy portfolio standards. He was kind of the key figure behind that effort. That bill never got passed. He was, a key person who tried to sponsor a bill directing DEQ to ignore the EPA's Clean Power Plan. That also didn't go too far. Former Duke Energy employee, environmental groups often latched onto that when he would make these efforts. So, yeah, he's a key figure. And I sat in a couple subcommittee meetings, not this session, but last session. He's very active during those. He goes over, talks to other people. He asks a lot of very pointed questions. So, yeah, this is a big deal.
Yes. Environmental groups will be happy. Speaker Moore, I imagine, will be happy. I don't want to put words in his mouth. I'm very confident the environmental groups are happy. And I'm sure we'll see some kind of statement in the next day or two from the Speaker's office thanking Representative Hager for his service and his hard work. I mean, that's customary. And, that's the show of party unity there. It's important for them, for the Republicans, to get another representative into the General Assembly from that seat. And perhaps we will learn more about this as things move forward. This is news that I believe broke either late Friday or early Saturday morning as we chat here on a Monday morning. So maybe more to come on this, and maybe not. But Mike Hager, I would imagine, will be heard from again, whether that's a run for office again down the road if he, you know, decides to step into the sphere of lobbying in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
We shall see.
Yeah. He was also a vocal supporter of Donald Trump, which was not uninteresting. And when you, especially this year, when you are seeing a lot of division among Republicans, whether they supported Trump or didn't support Trump, that was noteworthy. Governor Pat McCrory, an attorney, switching gears here a little bit. Governor Pat McCrory, Attorney General, Governor candidate Roy Cooper, has set a date for their second debate. The two will meet on October 11th with Meet the Press's Chuck Todd moderating. No other debates have been scheduled as yet, and there may or may not be any. Jeff, it's possible this could be the only debate between the two candidates between now and Election Day. Why is that?
These two don't agree on much, and they certainly haven't been able to agree on the specifics, the framework, the details of a debate. As we've talked about in recent weeks here, McCrory wants a series of forms. He wants 5, 6, 7, we've heard at times as many as 9 debates, which is an awful lot.
Which is exactly the opposite of what incumbents usually want.
Historically, the challenger wants that for name recognition, for a boost in the polls, for help. Roy Cooper is ahead in this race, according to polls. A recent Marist poll that came out on Friday, along with NBC and Wall Street Journal, pegged the attorney general challenging the incumbent up by 7 points, which is his largest lead yet. So October 11th is, I mean, that's 2 months. That's almost 2 months from now. That's a long way away. I would say that's advantage Cooper in terms of not having another forum, because, you know, let's note that Roy Cooper is not somebody who's holding regular press conferences and taking questions from the media. He is raising money and doing that quite well over the last year and a half. And he is having some forums where he answers questions about tech or answers questions about business. But he, in some ways, similar to Hillary Clinton, is not having a steady, constant media presence.
Right.
So he's, to that point, my perception is he's controlling the message. He's really, you know, controlling what gets out. His mouthpiece is narrow, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then October 11th, so remember, early voting is just 2 weeks after. It starts just 2 weeks after that. So that feels pretty late in the game to me in terms of a debate.
Certainly seems like that is going to be the only debate.
If
they're talking about that one, they're not going to probably put one between now and then. And after then would be too late. So it's really interesting timing. It seems like that's the only debate. And what you hit on really are these clear campaign strategies that have sort of started to evolve and started to show itself. And while we talk about Governor Pat McCrory's challenges and issues and all of that, it's interesting to look at, Cooper's, not doing a lot. You said not doing a lot of press,
right?
Doing a lot of Q&As, one debate, a lot of television media,
a lot of
advertising. Yep. You're going to see a ton of advertising here between now and Election Day. So that it's a bit of a flip. You see he's running like an incumbent,
right? Like it's his race to lose.
Like it's and if you believe that sort of amazing poll that came out Friday from Marist, Wall Street Journal, and NBC, that showed Hillary Clinton with a significant lead over Donald Trump.
9,
it showed,
I believe.
Cooper with a lead over McCrory, and it showed Ross with a lead over Burr
for the first time.
Now that one was within the margin of error.
Sure,
but
what's worth noting is that just a month ago, the same polling institute had Burr up 7 points. So. We're seeing a shift there, and I think some of this is coming out of the conventions, and some of this is part of what, again, based on numbers, is the national distaste or the growing skepticism, call it what you want, about candidate Trump. But Deborah Ross and Senator Burr, I mean, this has moved firmly to a toss-up race, and this is one of those races that the Democrats across the country are targeting a Republican incumbent to try to take back the U.S. Senate. And what's interesting about the Burr race to me is that there are a series of Republican incumbents that Democrats have targeted who are one-term incumbents. We're talking like Ron Johnson from Wisconsin and Rob Portman from Ohio, and there are several others. But they're looking at Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire. They're looking at one-term incumbents. Burr is a two-term incumbent, and he's head of the Foreign Intelligence Committee, and that would seem on paper like a bit of a loftier. Good luck with that, trying to take him down, trying to unseat him. But in this year of, political, upheaval, unrest, call it what you will, Deborah Ross and Burr heading down what seems to be a narrow finish. I think 2 points worth noting on them. One, Burr, and this is as of last Thursday, Burr's campaign told me he's got about $7 million in the bank, cash on hand, as they refer to it, and she has about $2 million, or a little less than $2 million in the bank. So he has a sizable money advantage at this point. Of course, you know, you could hang on to all that. I mean, how do they spend it? When will they spend it?
Right.
Is it in TV ads?
She's largely undefined in the minds of a lot of voters, so you can assume that a lot of that is going to be negative advertising, trying to define her before she can define herself. But that poll told me something, and polls in August are...
Right, you got to take everything with a grain of salt.
That's right. How helpful is it? But what it told me was the stumbles of the Trump campaign are having an impact down the ticket. And this was Art Pope's worry when he was talking, you know, a couple months ago. He's not a Trump supporter. He is a big supporter of down ticket races for the Republicans. And that seems to be having an impact.
Yes.
So a lot, you know, you've seen, I think, of all the candidates Republican running for statewide office, that Richard Burr has had the hardest time deciding how he's going to deal with Donald Trump and whether he's going to align or not align. He's taking a wait-and-see approach, it seems like.
Yeah, and there are certain things he has distanced himself from and gotten a little closer to him on others. Mm-hmm. I don't believe have we seen Burr with Trump on the campaign trail?
I believe he was at the Winston-Salem rally.
Okay.
That
right.
McCrory was
there as well.
Was there as well.
Raving about Mike Pence, but
right, and neither one of them spoke about Trump specifically. And but he wasn't in Fayetteville or Wilmington last week with Trump for sure.
Right. This is a tough one. And as we've seen some various national media articles recently talking about the strategy that the National Republican Party is talking about behind closed doors is if and when to abandon the efforts for Trump and really focus on down ballot races, congressional races and Senate races and gubernatorial races. There are some Republican strategists that say this is already happening.
Mm-hmm.
And for Burr, it appears as though he's going to need some kind of help. Now, that help could come from the sizable cash advantage he has. It could come from a forum or two, a debate, if he performs well. I mean, my perception of Senator Burr is that he's pretty affable. He's a pretty likable guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's well known, and the name recognition is there. So you know, will that take place? A debate like he had 6 years ago with Elaine Marshall, and then what kind of support is he going to get from outside groups, from the national organization? And it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out, because as you mentioned, Trump is this giant X factor, this variable that I'm unaware of any candidates he's clearly helping at this point.
Right. No, that will be interesting to watch. And just watching how that campaign has to pivot or not pivot away from the presidential candidate and when it will do that is going to be fascinating to watch. Now, speaking of Trump, the Trump campaign went on a blistering attack against the media this weekend, particularly the New York Times. That's nothing new. But it really has become a Republican strategy that seems to have kicked up a level recently, this attacking of the media. Jeff, have you noticed an intensified attack on the media? I think we've seen some of that. Governor Pat McCrory has done some of that, blame a lot of media. That's not new.
No.
Democratic governors have blamed media as well for different things.
Right.
But it really does seem that there's a different level of intensity to it than there used to be. Are you noticing that?
I think that it is dialed up. Admittedly, I haven't covered politics for 20 or 30 years, and I've only been a reporter for 10 years or so. But this feels different to me. I don't remember this kind of distaste or venom from, and we can go national or state or local campaigns, but I don't recall this, you know, when we think back to the 08 or 12 elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the General Assembly. I mean, I think some of it's the game, right? Like some of it
sure.
is part of it, and that's the language that is used. And Senator Berger, for example, you know, pro tem, probably the most powerful elected official in the state from Rockingham County. Senator Berger will say, has said many releases, whether it's about HB2 or it's about redistricting. He'll use some of that language about, you know, the media is unfair, the media, the liberal media. And sometimes they tie in the word national. To Senator Berger's credit, he's always available. He'll always chat with us. I mean, he's cagey, as most politicians are, and he doesn't have a whole lot to say in terms of substance and detail. But it's interesting that, you know, on one hand, you've got people who will rip the media and will say, you know, you're terrible, you're so liberal, you're activists, whatever the case may be. And then they'll they'll turn around and they'll talk to you.
Yeah.
Which to me seems like a disconnect.
Right. There was in 2008, I was covering the McCain visit to Raleigh, Crown Arena, a lot of people. And I'd covered all of the candidates at that point and varying levels of sort of disgruntlement with the media. But I remember sitting there. I was one of the first ones there. National media hadn't gotten there yet. Probably 10,000 people there. And a local lawmaker, state lawmaker, gets up. You know, they have this sort of long list of people who get up to speak. He gets up to speak.
The undercard.
And he gets up to speak, and he just starts ripping the media, pointing right at sort of the area where the media is sitting. They're the ones who are doing this. And people are getting all up and hostile and yelling and screaming.
This was a McCain event?
This was a McCain event, 2008. And I was probably one of three total people sitting there at the time, right? And you're kind of going, you're typing and keeping your head down and pretending not to pay attention. And then I remember everybody, you know, he gets them all whipped in a frenzy. Then the music starts. He walks off and he walks. And the way that the people who spoke had to walk off, they had to walk down and he's still pointing at people. He walks out across and he walks right by where the media is sitting. And he looks at us and he just kind of smiles, goes, "Hey, how's it going, fellas?" And it wasn't because he was taunting or anything. It was just, it was a total part of the game. Right. This was another one of those lawmakers who had a reputation for being accessible and talking.
Who?
More than happy. I don't want to say who it was. But he was one of these people who's happy to tell you what he thought about things and everything else. But that was part of the game. Whip everybody into a frenzy. And there were people who would turn around and scream at you every once in a while. A little bit of that. But not that much. It was all part of the game. And the people in the audience kind of knew it too, but what has changed now is I think that level of anger has built up to a point where those folks will now turn to people in the media, especially these Trump events where they're all the media is sort of in this little paddock area and really start to.
Yeah, it feels different at Trump events.
It feels different. You feel a little more physically at risk. Uh-huh. Yeah. There have been reporters who've had to have Secret Service walk to their car and that kind of thing. That's a little bit different than usual. Now, the media is not in any danger. And the media is not really a thing. It's a bunch of journalists who all have different ideas on how to do their jobs. And so just classifying all the, you know, we're a lot different from, you know, cable TV shows. And,
We're different than CNN.
Everybody just
and Fox
has a different
News
mission and a different way of doing things.
Right.
But it's really easy to paint the media as villains in this. And sometimes, quite frankly, we are a little bit. Not you and I. But I think there's media who do things that make me question their bias, not only bias, but their point of view. You know, some people put a point of view ahead and then find some facts to meet it.
Right.
On all across the political spectrum.
Right. And not to get too far into semantics, there's media and then there's that's the top line of the tree, right? And then, or the triangle, the umbrella, whatever. And then you've got journalism and you've got entertainment.
That's right.
And I mean, some of this is rubbish. Some of this is entertainment. Right. I think the problem, I don't mean to sound holier than thou, but I think the problem is some people don't know the delineation. You tune into Inside Edition, or you tune into Hannity, or you tune into Rush Limbaugh.
Right. They don't know the difference between that and a reported piece in the New York Times.
Right.
They think it's all the same.
And that's not only on the consumer. I mean, I think that the NPR has run into issues with this, and other media outlets have run into issue with this when the line, to me as a consumer and as a journalist, can be very blurred sometimes between, you know, reporter and then news analyst. Well, news analyst is a commentator, is a columnist with his or her voice. So we drift between these things sometimes, and I think it's dangerous isn't the right word. It's tough to.
It's confusing.
Yeah, it's confusing.
It's
that's
confusing.
Thank you.
No, it's very confusing, and it's you know, even how things are reported. There are so many people who just sit in front of a computer and get other people's sources and put together a story and put it out there.
Right, that's BuzzFeed,
and
right?
That's right.
Well, they have reporters now, but
That is happening a lot, and even traditional media outlets do this. And then there are folks like you who spend a lot of time in the legislature, who parse the information, who fact check it, who do all these things and put out a story. And oftentimes, the really educated, really well-versed people in different forms of media can't tell the difference between those two things. So how do we expect to tell them the difference between whether somebody is a news commentator or a reporter?
Right. And I agree with all that. And I one of the other challenges, I think, is Trump, because he's so different and he's so incendiary and volatile. So two examples. One, the Second Amendment comment from, I guess, last week. Was it just last week? And then the wall. So the Second Amendment thing, and I think that some outlets did a decent job of this, but he says something that Hillary Clinton cannot, regardless of what you feel about guns or about her or about him, She cannot repeal, she cannot amend the U.S. Constitution. That would take many steps. She can't do that, let alone the fact she's never said that. So I think it's important from a storytelling standpoint or from a journalist standpoint to include that.
Right.
I mean, he says, oh, she wants to repeal the Second Amendment. Well, we should note that Hillary Clinton cannot do, like, that she just doesn't have that power.
Right.
And another one that to me with Trump has been frustrating as a reporter is the whole wall thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when that emerged, and I mean, that's been around for a year now, unless I'm missing something, and I'm not here, Donald Trump doesn't do the budget. The president doesn't have control over hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, Congress does a budget. Donald Trump doesn't. He doesn't have the money or the resource. He can't build a wall on his own. And I think over time, he was called on that. He was pushed for more details about how would you pay for this wall? And then it was like, well, I'll make Mexico pay for it. This is such a preposterous thing. And we've talked about the wall, I think, months ago here. But it's so long. He can't do that. So I think the media is in a tough spot. Like, how do you cover that? How do you, like, how do you not attack him? Or fairly and impartially go after someone who's saying something that's ridiculous, or whether it's one of his comments that are racist, or
how do you apply the same level of skepticism across the sort of board, when what one candidate is saying, there are things in there that are clearly just misrepresentations or flat out
nonsense. You're not going to build a 3,000-mile wall. And conversely, Hillary, hater, lover, thinks she should go to prison, thinks she should be the 45th president, whatever. She's not saying anything that's remotely like that, juxtaposed to that.
Right.
So where is fairness in this? Like, fairness to me is very difficult to reach. And then with these two candidates, it's like, ugh.
Well, and you talk about how, well, Trump can't build a wall. Well, the other part of that is aside to that is Pat McCrory didn't pass House Bill 2 by himself.
Right.
He signed it, he is clearly the face of it and defends it in public. People ask him about it.
Right.
And it does, there's that, and that's always been the case for all politicians, elected lawmakers forever. But then you have Trump, and it's sort of the same, but it really kind of isn't either, because he is doing things and saying things that no politician has ever done before. So it is not only difficult to cover if you're a consumer. I don't know how you sort of make sense of all this.
Right.
I think it's really difficult.
I think that's one challenge that the media has had, is how much to challenge Trump and go after him, because what he's done is he has built, no pun intended, but he's built this wall up to some extent, trying to keep the media out and criticizing the media and going after the media. And I think in turn, for some outlets, for some reporters, I think it's only natural to think that may make you tap the brakes as you go after him, or you might challenge him in a different way because you think, all right, well, am I biased? Am I really going after him? Or are you just trying to get at the facts of what may be a ludicrous statement?
Right. It's only going to get more difficult. It's going to get more difficult. Not just with Trump, I think, but
particularly if he is our next president.
Yeah, but he's changing the playing field.
Right.
Not just for himself, but for all politics and all candidates.
Yes.
So that cannot be a bad thing, but it certainly is a different situation.
Oh, it could be,
Could be a very bad
thing. It could be a very bad thing.
Could be a very bad thing. So that does it for the WUNC Politics Podcast this week. Jeff, thanks.
Absolutely.
Make sure to subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast on iTunes and Google Play. Follow all the WUNC Politics stories on air and online. See you next week.